You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa. No mā haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whaake nei, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the Middle East, Air New Zealand shares, and move-on orders for rough sleepers. I also spoke to Iranian political scientist and activist Samira Qureshi about the escalating conflict in the Middle East. I spoke to Chief Executive of Te Heringa Mahara, Karen Osborne, about youth struggles to access mental health support services in Aotearoa. And I spoke to President of Living Streets Aotearoa, Tim Jones, about a set of new transport proposals, particularly as they affect pedestrians and cyclists. He aha o whakaro, we'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o erirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more, as always, by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, ACT Party leader David Seymour called on the government to sell its shares in Air New Zealand. The statements followed the half-year $40 million loss at the end of 2025, which followed a profit the year before of $106 million. Seymour criticised Air New Zealand for going woke, which included electric planes, glossy reports on climate change, and paper cups in the Koru Lounge. This past week also saw the government propose expanding police powers to enforce move-on orders for rough sleepers across the country. The government says this order will help reduce disorderly behaviour and ensure the public can feel and are safe. However, the order would not just target those who are disorderly or disruptive, but also any form of begging, rough sleeping, or intention to inhabit a public space. The proposal has been criticised for multiple reasons, including as an inadequate solution, failing to address the cause of the problem, and as unnecessarily cruel measures against those who are already struggling. This weekend also saw conflict escalating between multiple powers in the Middle East, most notably between Israel and Iran. In our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, Simon Court asked about each of these issues, beginning with a quick question on the government's stance on issues in the Middle East.
Do you have anything you'd like to say on the developing situation in the Middle East?
Well, Iran has spent decades funding their proxies in Hezbollah and Hamas. They've been destabilising their neighbours and pursuing a nuclear weapons capability that has terrified their neighbours and the wider world. And none of this has happened in a vacuum. Israel has its right to defend itself against what has been a constant threat, death to Israel, and of course United States. You know, the Ayatollah, RIP, was always saying death to America. And in the end, something was going to have to happen. And what we've seen over the past few days is the US and Israel coordinating and planning to take out that violent and repressive leadership.
Why do David Seymour and the ACT Party believe that the government should be selling these shares?
Well, it's because if the Crown has billions of dollars tied up in an airline or any other business, New Zealanders should be seeing reliable services and competitive prices coming back from this airline. And right now, travellers are seeing the opposite. And that's why ACT is saying, look, the airline needs to get back to first principles, because Kiwis trying to book a flight to the regions, or if you're a student travelling, say, to a university in the South Island, and you're faced with $900 return tickets, the sustainability reports and future electric flying aviation concepts don't matter at all. And that's why ACT is saying, look, if this airline can't turn its business around and offer good services at reasonable prices, then their ownership structure needs to be looked at.
There's a bit of historical context for privatisation of Air New Zealand. In October 1989, the government sold its shares, which then led subsequently to a buyout in 2001 costing about $900 million. What would make this time any different?
Well, the government has lots of capital tied up in assets, and in many cases, these are lazy assets. The New Zealand Initiative has just released a report today identifying $24 billion of capital that could be recycled into infrastructure that we actually need. Because if you think about what the Infrastructure Commission said a few weeks ago in the National Infrastructure Plan proposal, we're about $200 billion short for everything from hospitals, schools, defence, stormwater and wastewater infrastructure, and that's before you even get to roads. So there is a case for recycling the capital, but whether Air New Zealand can turn itself around and actually deliver fair value to taxpayers and to customers remains to be seen. And, you know, at a certain point in time, government ownership of all of these assets, ACT would say, needs to be looked at very carefully.
That's not quite the question I asked, though. I'm looking to hear whether you're confident that if Air New Zealand were to be sold, if Air New Zealand shares were to be sold by the government, that the government wouldn't need to then later step in and buy them back.
Well, I can't obviously predict the future. If I could do that, I wouldn't be a civil engineer and now a member of parliament. You know, I'd be betting on the stock market myself. But what I can say is that government-owned companies have typically underperformed the market year on year. They do not feel the pressure that customers in the private sector put on private businesses. They're insulated, and as a result, they get lazy. Their attention drifts into matters like sustainable biofuels and electric aeroplanes that Air New Zealand spent $6 million flying backwards and forwards across Cook Strait as if no one can actually buy a drone out of a box to deliver a package. And so what ACT would say is, look, while we can't predict the future, can absolutely guarantee that businesses under private sector management are far more successful and deliver far better services to their customers than businesses that are under government ownership and management.
And those biofuels and electric planes, they come into some of what Seymour was saying about the losses we saw at Air New Zealand. He also mentioned some other stuff that came under this umbrella of going woke. Could you elaborate on what that means and how that resulted in losses at Air New Zealand?
Well, David Seymour might have seen the same things that I have. I mean, Air New Zealand runs an annual event at Parliament every year. And, you know, when I watched their introduction to the airline under this new CEO, the first 20 minutes of their video presentation to hundreds and hundreds of invited guests didn't feature an aeroplane. It featured culture, it featured nature, and all kinds of aspirational things that an airline doesn't really need to concern itself with. It needs to make sure its planes run on time, that its engines are serviced and operating, and that its crews are trained and, you know, ready to deliver good service to their customers. I think David Seymour's picking up on maybe some of the things that I saw. If you're 20 minutes into your promotional video in front of hundreds of invited guests and you haven't mentioned an aeroplane, maybe your focus is a bit wonky.
I want to move on now to the rough sleepers change. Why is this coming about now?
Well, New Zealanders should not have to run a gauntlet of intimidation to walk down their own main street. And move-on powers are simply about giving the police the ability to step in earlier when people become aggressive or obstructive or threatening. Now, I've had personal experience of this, and so have many staff who've worked for me on projects and in businesses in Auckland. You know, I ran a civil construction road maintenance alliance out of East Street just off Kay Road for 3 years and then moved over to Hereford Street to run Auckland's ultra-fast broadband civil works. We had dozens of staff coming to and from our premises early in the morning, leaving late in the evening, and every day we would get reports of that type of intimidation or obstruction, or frankly just completely antisocial behaviour. It was scary to our staff, and particularly younger staff and women coming to and from the office, out of daylight hours when it was dark. It was a real concern. So I understand this at a deeply personal level, and you've got to think of all the businesses, all of those people who you know, want customers to come. If there's somebody sleeping in their doorway or who's peed in the doorway, you know, who on earth is going to want to come into that business? And that's why this government says, look, you know, we understand that homelessness is not a crime. These people have had some kind of a tough, some kind of tough situation, or they've made poor choices, but their situation is not a crime. But also, their situation should not be imposed on others.
There's some words you mentioned there: aggressive, obstructive, or threatening behaviour, and that's how the government has been presenting this change. However, if you look into what the proposal actually dictates, it's not just things that are aggressive, obstructive, or threatening behaviours. You know, some things in there like begging, like trying to live in a place, like slightly obstructing a doorway. These are changes, these are things that homeless people might be doing because they want to stay alive, as opposed to impede on someone else's safety or impede on someone else's way of life. This change seems unnecessarily cruel. Could you respond to that?
Well, I've made it absolutely clear. It is about obstructing doorways where people are trying to operate a business. It is about people trying to set up camp on private property or in public places that, you know, essentially creates an antisocial environment and discourages normal people going to and from work, or people who live in places like the CBD in Auckland, CBD in Wellington, and of course increasing demand for urban living in places like Hamilton, Tauranga, and Christchurch. Yeah, it's a real dark and sad situation that a lot of these people are in, but they don't get to impose their behaviours. They don't get to obstruct doorways of businesses and premises simply because they've made poor decisions in their lives or they're suffering from some kind of situation. There is help available, and I know that the government has continued to reinforce that, and ACT would also want to be absolutely sure that help is available for these people. The thing is, they haven't been required to take it because they know that the police haven't had the power to move them on. But with these move-on orders and having these services in place, I'm confident that a lot more of these people are going to get the help that they need.
You've created a bit of a narrative here about these people creating harmful or antisocial environments and that they should be moved on for the good of the public. In the change, in the proposal, it's going to affect people as young as 14 years old. What is the rationale there? These are practically children being affected.
Children should not be living on the street. They should not be living on the street because they're incredibly vulnerable and they could be preyed on by people who are not just antisocial, but who are criminals. There are social services available for 14-year-olds who are homeless. I think the whole point is here. Rather than allowing them to establish a life on the street, they need to be moved on and they need to be moved into care or into services where they can get help. But, you know, I could reiterate example after example of disgusting antisocial behaviour that is terrifying, that is obnoxious, and that actually stops people from going about their business. I've seen people taking a dump over a catch pit in East Street in the middle of the day. Now, whether you have a move-on order or not, that is completely unacceptable behaviour. And some of the things that I've seen coming to work early in the morning, you know, some of the things staff have told me about what they've been exposed to is completely unacceptable. Now, New Zealanders overwhelmingly support move-on orders on the basis that there is help or there is a service for people to go to. This government is going to make sure that the social services are there, they are there, and these people are going to have an opportunity to use them rather than essentially being left to fester and live terrible lives on the street.
Yeah, and that seems to be the crux of the issue here, on the basis that there is help on the other end. This government has cut social services, cut benefits across the board. We've seen homelessness stay relatively the same under the course of this government, even go up in some places. Is that something that people can be confident in? You know, the government is saying, sure, we'll move on these people, and there's the claim that they'll be going to safer places, better places for them, but the government's been giving us evidence exactly to the contrary.
Well, Castor, I don't know what evidence you're citing, but this government spends around $5 billion a year on social housing, including public housing, through accommodation grants, emergency grants, and obviously funding NGOs, social agencies to deliver programs. So yeah, $5 billion a year is a heck of a lot of money. When it comes to homelessness statistics, I know that opposition parties have been bandying around the fact homelessness has increased. It hasn't. The number of rough sleepers has decreased by some hundreds over the past year or so. And you know, what we want to do in the long run is make housing affordable and sustainable for people who currently are at the margins. But there are some behaviours and there are some individuals who cannot live on the street, intimidating business people trying to open up their business, who employ people, who are afraid to come to work, you know, or just people getting on and off the bus, getting harassed by beggars. Like, we have a social safety net. We spend billions and billions of dollars. I think it's somewhere in the region of $11 billion a year on social welfare and programs overall in New Zealand. So look, I'm confident the services are there, and I think this is an entirely constructive and practical response to all of the demands that we've heard from people, you know, who have businesses in the city, live in the city, come and go from our major cities, that something needs to be done about this. And this government has the courage and the fortitude to do what is necessary.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about conflict in the Middle East, Air New Zealand shares, and move-on orders for rough sleepers.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Are our affairs current?
Richard, great question.
The Wire.
You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School. Checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts and the one show to know.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
Get Down Services are venturing to our shores to entertain the masses with their magnificent chaos. Double whammy on June 2nd.
You'll be eating out of this Bristol duo's hands as they perform their gloriously unhinged blend of scrappy indie, post-funk and disco-fueled grooves.
Get Down Services. Double whammy, June 2nd. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Get out your speediest eyewear. The B-Rave is back and faster than ever before. B-Rave, Friday, March 6th at the Mothership.
Stepping up to the booth for your entertainment is a host of iconic 95 BFM DJs, including Co-Governance,
Rosetta from Breakfast, Nicholas from Drive,
Stinky Jim, Naru, back-to-back babyface killer, Porcelain, back-to-back pros.
Race you there. 95 BFM, Spades, Kira Huketsu, and Under the Radar present B-Rave at the Mothership. Friday, March 6th. Tickets available now at Under the Radar.
Ah, guys, he finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no, what if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's the beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95 BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7 p.m. every weekday only on 95 BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
North to south, and she
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Helicopter by Block Party.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
This past weekend saw tensions in the Middle East rising, with Israel and the United States launching strikes on Iran yesterday, killing Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. Iran responded by launching strikes on Israel, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Kuwait. The conflict follows tensions between the United States, Israel, and Iran, which in turn followed protests across Iran earlier this year. As the situation develops, the internal and external politics of Iran are precarious, and all parties remain interested in who could take power. To discuss how the events came about and how they'll affect domestic politics in Iran, I spoke to political scientist and activist Samira Qureshi. Qureshi spoke to 95BFM in an independent capacity. Get into it. If you could just introduce your name and how we should refer you, that'd be great.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Samira Qureshi, and Iranian independent researcher and activist, mainly advocate for women's rights and children's rights back in Iran and here.
Yeah, and so for our listeners, I guess, unfamiliar with Middle Eastern politics, really briefly, for some context, why has this most recent conflict come about?
Oh, good question. Thanks for asking. I think it's really important to build that context because, you know, it's really important to highlight first internally the Islamic regime is really had for decades an oppressive security apparatus, oppressing any dissident political or views, you know, and voices. So definitely this is an internal issues and also oppressive policies, foreign policies, that ambition of, you know, these nuclear and stuff and also those proxies in the region, as many people already know. But also in terms of economy, very corrupted economy at the same time. And unfortunately, in last couple of technically years, more than a decade, I have to say, those general sanction against Iran actually result in more corruption in this way that Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps could build even like a very...
And so for our listeners, I guess, unfamiliar with Middle Eastern politics, really briefly, for some context, why has this most recent conflict come about?
I think it's really important to build that context because, you know, it's really important to highlight first internally the Islamic regime is really had for decades an oppressive security apparatus, oppressing any dissident political or views, you know, and voices. So definitely this is an internal issues and also oppressive policies, foreign policies, that ambition of, you know, these nuclear and stuff and also those proxies in the region, as many people already know. But also in terms of economy, very corrupted economy at the same time. And unfortunately, in last couple of technically years, more than a decade, I have to say, those general sanction against Iran actually result in more corruption in this way that Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps could build even like a very corrupted black market and dominating technically the economy. So this is internally, but also I feel that we are here, unfortunately. So I want to be very clear, the first responsible for this situation for people of Iran definitely are the Islamic regime and those in power. But we shouldn't also forget the fact that for decades, Iranian people, those like me, actually researchers who monitor the social movements and protests and civil society activism in Iran, we know very well that people from the first years of a revolution, constantly they resisted. They have different protests. We just hear those big ones, but it's ongoing. And recent research actually just showing just between 2009 to 2024, just in Tehran, we had almost one protest something every 3 days. This is huge, despite the fact these people know they will face bullet, they will face violent oppression, and every time bigger demonstration, every time worse situation in terms of oppressive, violent oppression. And this means people were sending messages that something is wrong with this regime. And we, outside and inside, we did lots of advocacy asking international community for taking some tangible actions. But unfortunately, not properly heard. People feel abandoned, technically. And now, look where we are, because just after this massacre in Iran, we can hear that European Union, for example, just one of the actions, they put, they designated IRGC as a terrorist organization. And that was one among so many actions that was requested. And look now where we are. So I think, yes, that's a bit of background, I would say.
And we saw yesterday Supreme Leader of Iran Ali Khamenei was killed. What kind of political climate will that leave in his wake?
I have to say, you know, I'm not really trying to, you know, we always leave people of Middle East, we always hold a hope. That hope is our resistance. But if I put my political science hats on, unfortunately, and also living in Iran, studying about Iran, we have to understand that in the head of this regime, like Khamenei gone, doesn't necessarily mean the regime fall, huh? Because actually we are talking about a regime that has been actually vertically integrated over decades, ideologically embedded. So that's why now I'm worried that they make like a symbol of Khamenei now by some even non-Iranian fan and supporter over in the Shia world, and also militarized through parallel institutions and sustained also by very different networks. I'm not just mentioning about those proxies that have been weakened by Israel, of especially after 12-day war. There are so many different networks, and this is the whole of this regime working. So it's not that easy that we would like to see it, you know, unfortunately. Yeah, I don't think that, understandably, many Iranians are happy, but I also understand them that they are full of uncertainty and anxious about the future, because
the US narrative around what's been going on in Iran has been, you know, a narrative of freeing people from corrupt leadership. However, we've also seen a lot of US interference in the Middle East result in a lot of harm to domestic populations. How does that balance, do you think, and how will that play out in Iran going forward?
Oh, another great question, because I think, I know that many maybe Iranian want to see this as help, because Trump said help is coming, but actually he never been very clear what type of help. Many Iranian advocates and activists, they call for humanitarian intervention, civilian focused, targeted humanitarian support. That is different from what we see here. Calling that, oh, this is for freedom of people in Iran, I would be very careful about this one. I would be careful to accept it. To me, is my concern is more around how exploiting decades of people's movement, freedom movement, for the geopolitical interest. We are talking about, on the one hand, we have that theocratic system, oppressive fascism, technically, system of Islamic regime. But also, on the other hand, the involved groups are Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. That these two also, they don't have really good record when it comes to human rights, individual rights, and democracy and peace. So we need to be very careful about this one, to accept it. affected. And also there are so many evidence you mentioned about the previous, you know, the background of the United States and military-led interventions. There is really amazing work. I don't know if people like to read it, Advancing Democracy Abroad. In this book, they also mention very evidence-based that actually in modern era of during the foreign policy of the United States, only 4 of 17 military US-led military intervention technically can produce a kind of relatively positive democracies, and in most cases has unfortunately results hasn't been very positive. And I think it really depends on not only how they do this intervention, but what follows after the intervention, which is something we have to very carefully monitor now. And also the context. The success depends on the context. Calling simply that now people coming out or now this is an opportunity to build your future, but actually that's not that easy in this context in Iran inside, that we are talking about a diverse population, big population. We are still talking about some, this IRGC is still there, huh? So they already started attacking people who came outside to celebrate the death of Khamenei. So, and now we hear from Trump, that's another concern, that he talks about, you know, he's not very clear, very contradictory messages, he says. He also talks about these, you know, military groups put their weapons down. I'm just, we need to be very careful. Does he really, another negative result of this military intervention, we know that when they back some political figure that really just benefit their interest, you know, the foreign interest, or sometimes when they prioritize the economic deals or, you know, like some short deals, short-term security over really a political change. I see that it's not yet clear that Trump has really clear political strategy, and concern is, are you looking for a less dangerous system? Are you, you know, what's exactly the plan? So this is really dangerous, I think, and that, these are some of my really quick concern that I would have, and would be careful to really accept this claim that it's for freedom of people. And at the same time, yes, every event like this one, we call it in politics kind of like it's a rapture. So it can open some opportunity, but not necessarily, you know, it's a horizon for a good change. It depends on so many factors that some of them I mentioned, particularly context. And I believe that at the end, technically, the positive one would be a collective from Iranian people. Unfortunately, with this situation that is unfolding, still we need to be careful, very uncertain. I cannot see be that very, very hopeful for that, you know.
We've seen tensions flaring up between Iran and other countries in the region, most notably Israel. How does that reflect domestic beliefs? Is that something that's developed just from the Ayatollah, or is that also something that we see among the Iranian people as well?
First, I think we need to remember that we are talking about Iranian people means a population over 90 million with very diverse views, political views, ideological views, and so on. Overall and general, also on the other hand, the fact actually is the Islamic regime was defined on the foundation of being enemy with Israel and United States. That's some of the foundation to define themselves against these two. And this kind of hostility and, as someone who lived in Iran and still, you know, so many families, friends, and in touch with them, This is not something you see among Iranians. Iranians always say that we don't have problem with people of Israel. We don't have problem with people of United States. Actually, the big population of Iranian abroad, outside Iran, over they live in United States. So it's not about any problem that people have with other people. And we heard also this from that side as well. And I think it's all politics. And it's heartbreaking to see people between all these powers and, you know, like a cut between these power games and geopolitical games, really.
That was political scientist and activist Samira Qureshi speaking to me about the conflict in the Middle East and how it interacts with Iranian domestic politics. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Long will I stay?
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Hardness in the Gut by Cicada.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Last week, Te Herenga Mahara, the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, released a series of data summaries on the state of youth mental health in Aotearoa. One of the key findings of the study was that, despite an increase in stress levels, fewer young people are accessing specialist mental health and addiction support services. To discuss the causes of the issue and how it can be addressed at multiple levels across society, I spoke to Chief Executive of Te Herenga Mahara, Karen Osborne.
If we're thinking about youth levels of distress, how do these compare to what we've seen in the past?
So we are seeing over time an increase in the rates of high and very high psychological distress amongst young people, and so that's started pre-COVID and has continued to increase, and it's sort of stabilised a little bit in the last year or so, but also that rate is high in comparison to other population groups. We'll also say that that's something that we're seeing globally, so it's not just in New Zealand, it's also in other countries.
Yeah, and do we know what the causes of this distress might look like?
Yeah, so we did some work a few years ago, and other people have as well, looking at what are the main drivers of that growth, and heard a lot from young people as well. So sort of distilled it down into four key areas. One was the world that young people live in and the pressures and challenges that they face. So about online safety, about the global financial crisis and financial challenges, climate change, also, as I said, online safety, experiencing racism and discrimination, but also that it's really important for having a sense of connection with family, whānau, with culture, is a really important sort of protective mechanism, and when it's not there, it can contribute to distress.
And while community is obviously very important, there's also these other places that young people can go to get support, right? Mental health support services. How are those keeping up, I guess, with this increased distress that we're seeing?
Yeah, so what we've seen over time is, particularly in the primary and community sector, we've seen the growth of services and youth-specific services as well. So the Access and Choice program, so that's got a range of options. So through a general practitioner, primary care place, through kaupapa Māori services, Pacific services and youth design services, plus there's other options such as Gumboot Friday, there's online options, there's other community-based options. So those are all really positive, and we're seeing close to 40,000 young people accessing those Access and Choice programs and others as well. So that's really positive. We had seen a decrease in numbers of people accessing specialist services, and for this most recent year, we've seen that for everyone, there's about 6,000 more people being seen in specialist services. But the there's a continued decline for the age range from 19 to 24. So we're really concerned about that particular age group, and because we know that that's a group that does have high needs. It's the age where more serious mental illness may have its onset. So it's really important that people of that age are able to access services in a timely way, and in particular the specialist services.
Yeah, and what's the cause of this decline? Is it, a lot of services, or sectors rather, have seen a decline in funding over recent years. Is it the same here?
Look, we don't believe it's funding related, because we have seen positive increases in funding for these services. It's a range of factors. We know that for the other people, workforce has made a big difference. So growing the workforce in specialist services has led to an increase in numbers of people accessing specialist services. So we're not sure why that's not the case for young people. So there's also challenges in terms of barriers of access and people being referred from primary community services into specialist services. And there's a bit more work that we need to do to understand what's happening in terms of that pathway from those services into specialist services.
Right, and so if we're now looking towards solutions, there's obviously multiple places where people look to mental health support, you know, at the family and friends level, at the community level, and then also at these wider levels. What could these solutions look like to increasing accessibility and increasing the way that our mental health support systems can work for young people?
And look, I think it's right across the board. And I think what's really important is that young people have a voice in determining what services are available and also the design of those services so that really do meet their needs. So that's starting right in terms of that promotion of wellbeing, supporting people to keep connected and to maintain that wellbeing through to access, early access to some of those more primary and community services when needed, be that community-based or in primary care, could be online options, telehealth options. There's a whole range of options that are available to people. But then if people do need them to be referred on to the more higher-end sort of secondary specialist services, that can happen in a timely way. So it's right across the system. And we did a deep dive looking at crisis responses, and that's something in particular that there are other options that can be available, such as crisis cafes, co-response teams, online options, telehealth options. So there's a lot that can be improved, and right across the system. And I would say we are seeing investment in those services and new services coming online, but we just need that real acceleration of rollout of those options.
We've seen also there's some stigma among young people in terms of reaching out for mental health support, especially from, you know, mental health providers, especially also among young men. Are there any solutions that we're looking into developing for that especially?
Yeah, and look, it's really pleasing to see that young people are more likely to reach out for help than perhaps previous generations. So there's a lot more of that narrative around mental health and mental wellbeing amongst younger people, and that's a real positive. I think the key is that co-design of services, so having youth voice in there, so increasing like the peer support workforce and the voice of people who have used services and say, you know, what is it that people need, what will make a difference, and working together in terms of saying or designing those services.
That was Chief Executive of Te Herenga Mahara, the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, Karen Osburn, speaking to me about a decline in youth accessing mental health support services.
Around, you know, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit. The Wire. The government recently announced 5 proposals to change transport rules in Aotearoa. The proposals include changes that would see e-scooters permitted in bike lanes and one that would allow cyclists aged 12 and below to use footpaths. While 4 of the changes have been celebrated by Living Streets Aotearoa, the first, around allowing more bikes on footpaths, has been criticised. The organisation says that this change could open a gateway to more bikes being permitted in pedestrian spaces, increasing risk, especially for the elderly and the disabled. To discuss their stance on the issue, I spoke to President of Living Streets Aotearoa, Tim Jones.
Let's get into it. If you could just start by introducing your name and title, please.
Kia ora, I'm Tim Jones, and I'm the President of Living Streets Aotearoa, which is a national organisation advocating for pedestrians and walking.
Yeah, and to start off with a bit of context, Living Streets Aotearoa, what are your takes on the new proposals from the government for transport?
Well, in short, we like 4 of the 5 proposals, that's proposals 2 through 5. We like, in particular, we like the proposal that e-scooters should be legally allowed to ride in cycle lanes, because that's something we and a lot of other groups and councils have been pushing for a long time. So we're really pleased to see that one. The one we particularly don't like is that children up to the age of 12 be allowed to ride full-size bikes, including e-bikes, on the footpath. And the reason we don't like that is because it puts pedestrians at greater risk. In particular, there is no speed restriction proposed, and e-bikes can go quick. So right now, you've got little kids riding on the footpath on small bikes, not full-size bikes. Not ideal for pedestrians, because we think footpaths are for people on foot, and people in low-speed mobility devices like wheelchairs. But having kids up to 12, and I know what I was like at 12, I was thinking it's great to hoon around with my mates. I wasn't thinking, I must be careful of these pedestrians. So having kids at up to age 12, riding fast, especially on e-bikes on the footpath, we think that's going to put pedestrians in danger, and it may well put people off walking at a time when we desperately need to be getting more people out of cars.
Yeah, and what are the risks of looking into e-bikes and e-scooters, especially around big urban areas like the CBD? What are the risks of riding around on footpaths as opposed to cycle lanes?
Well, basically, what the evidence shows is that what works well with traffic is, or with the allocation of road space, is that you put things moving at similar speeds in a lane together. We don't mix cars. We don't say, oh, well, there's a road, but what the hell, let's let cars go on the footpath. Now, of course, cars are more dangerous to pedestrians than e-bikes and e-scooters are. But moving at the speeds they can move, and optimally will move, let's say something like 25, 30 kilometres an hour, that's fine in a cycle lane. What we say is, where there is a cycle lane, it should be mandatory for bikes and e-scooters to be ridden there. Not just possible, but mandatory. If you have them on the footpath, there's two problems. One is the risk of accident or near misses. People moving quite slowly, which pedestrians do relative to bikes and e-scooters, do not mix well with devices moving at hard speed. I don't know if you've ever been run into by an e-scooter, but those things are heavy and they hurt. And it's bad enough for an able-bodied pedestrian. But if you've got, let's say, elderly pedestrians, people with disabilities, or maybe it's a parent with a pram and young kids, the risks are increased. There was a case just recently here in Wellington where a pedestrian was very seriously injured by a bike, by somebody on a bike who ran into them. That was on a shared path. So a shared path is where legally both bikes and pedestrians are allowed to go. We don't support shared paths in cities, and effectively this government proposal would be a step towards turning footpaths into shared paths. So we really support, and something it sometimes surprises people when I say this, as a pedestrian organisation, we support the development of cycle lanes. We think that's safer for cyclists, safer for e-scooter riders, as long as they're allowed to ride there, which they now will be, and safer for pedestrians.
Yeah, and alongside that, how do you think we can develop our transport infrastructure more broadly, including things like cars, buses and trains as well, to work better for all road users, especially around, again, those central city areas?
Well, I think it's interesting because I was actually in Auckland a couple of weeks ago and I was walking, I had some meetings and events in the Simon Street area, so I was walking around there quite a bit, and that was before Varsity started. So it wouldn't have been as busy as I guess it is now. But what I noticed is that, Auckland's a mix. There's some really great footpaths there, and there's also some narrow, bumpy ones. But more generally, filling up our cities with more roads, which in turn will mean more people travel by car, is not the way to go. What we need to be doing is providing better public transport, and of course Auckland's taking some really significant steps in that area at the moment. We need to have lanes set up so that yes, cars can go and buses can go, but that as much as possible we encourage people to travel on foot, by bike, even by e-scooter, as long as they're not going on the footpath. That's why we need to allocate space so there's good footpaths for pedestrians, good cycle lanes or good lanes for e-scooter riders, e-bike riders, bike riders, and road space. It's not easy, but if we continue as a country to go down the track where we're just putting more and more people in cars, that is just going to snarl up our cities even worse.
That was Tim Jones, president of Pedestrians Aotearoa, Living Streets Aotearoa, speaking about his stance on five proposals to change transport rules in Aotearoa.
All right, that's all I got prepared.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au, mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The Axe Party Simon Court, Iranian political scientist and activist Samira Gureshi, Chief Executive of Te Hiringa Mahara, Karen Osborne, and President of Living Streets Aotearoa, Tim Jones. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.